So there's a couple of things I'm going to talk about that are sort of development, but there's also some bigger questions. I'm sort of going to start with some very basic and obvious statements and, you know, just kind of ask some basic and general questions and then talk about how I at least fit these two pictures into that framework, you know, and kind of think a little bit more about, you know, what else you can do with this kind of an idea. So I imagine that by now you've heard all sorts of things about the how microfluidics is going to save the world. You know, there's lots of things that people do with them, and here are some. So one thing that that I actually like quite a bit about this field is I've sort of been in between a bunch of different fields, actually, as I've grown up. Physics, math, chemical engineering, you know, and I've interacted with people, and I think in 7 different departments, I counted at some point. So, you know, which, well, whatever. But one of the things that I really like about this field in general is that there's all sorts of stuff that happens. Right. There's lots of different physical phenomena that occur, all of which can be very important. And so, on some level, for somebody who's broadly interested in, you know, likes physics, it's a playground of sorts. And so, anyway, Steve Quake is Steve here? I think he's speaking next. Right? So he's flying in this morning, I'm sure. So anyway, he and I wrote this review that I just was going to give a sort of cheesy plug on. And anyway, we had fun doing it. So here's the thought. So this is the sort of the basic and kind of obvious things I'm going to say. So there's a lot of reasons that people use porous media, right? I mean, they're used extensively in microfluidics, for example, oftentimes for separations. I mean, gel matrices for separation. You can use, well, I mean, there's lots of ways you can think about this, but there are many ways that porous media are sort of relevant in the real world, and I would argue important in microfluidics. And so at some level, you know, another thing that you can say is that, you know, the stuff's been studied for a good century or more, right? At least porous media have been. And so I kind of want to invert this question. Instead of kind of asking about, well, given, you know, given some properties of a porous media, what are the transport, you know, phenomena that occur within it and so on, kind of try to invert that and say, well, we're in a position now where we can design, right? I mean, you're microfabricating these little things anyway, right? So on some level, you can make them whatever you like. So on some level, you can design a porous medium, if you like, just microfabricate it directly, right? And so what all can be gained by doing this? This is, I would say also, it's probably a fair statement that that a lot of the physics community on some level got into this thanks to Bob Austin. Maybe that's not an entirely fair statement. But he had sort of been thinking, you know, along these lines, you know, trying to take, you know, disordered polymer gels for DNA separation and try to do it more systematically by microfabricating basically, you know, posts, arrays of posts. You know, he'd been doing that since the late 90s. You know, the idea of systematically and rationally improving separation. So on some level, this is an extension of that, but I'm trying to think even a bit more broadly. So in general, you know, given all of the things that you can think about in porous media, and given all of the techniques that in the last 15 years or so have been developed to generate exciting and exotic porous media, you know, what can we do, right? So, I mean, I just kind of bring up a number of them. I mean, there's sort of these hierarchically porous media. You know, you can play with the symmetry of the pores themselves. You can play with the surface chemistry of the pores themselves, the symmetry of the surface chemistry, and so on. And so this is sort of the general idea that you know, on some level, I want you to keep in mind. And I'm going to talk about two specific, I don't know if you'd call them manifestations of that idea, but two specific examples. The first one is sort of a cute, I would say, a cute story. That's the one on the left here. A cute story that involves this theme, and it's kind of wraps together quite nicely. And the other one is work that comes out of work that I did with Martin Bazant, who is not here to my knowledge, but combines a whole lot of what I think are pretty ideas and kind of culminates in this theme. So I will start with this. So this is all, so the basically the experimental and simulational work that I will show you is all done by a graduate student at Harvard named Max Narodlansky, who works in George Whiteside's group. So he has done the lion's share of the work by far, and basically should be acknowledged as such. Okay, so I'm going to start again with a simple idea, which is that, okay, if you want to actually take different species and separate them, right, so electrokinetically separate them, what do you do? So I have a cartoon of some little blob, some red things, some blue things, and you want to separate them, right? They could be proteins, colloids, DNA, whatever you like. Okay, you apply an electric field. basically the different, you know, when they have different zeta potentials, if you know what that means, great. If you don't, it doesn't matter. But basically different species will travel at different rates based on their properties, okay? And so to clearly resolve and to differentiate between this species of analyte versus this, basically the slowest guy, basically the guy in the back, right, the fastest guy in the rear of the plug has to outrun the slowest guy in the front of the plug, right? And so once you do that, then you've resolved these two different species, okay? All sorts of competing effects come in. Sandeep Gosal, I believe, talked about this. I was teaching. And so anyway, you can think about this in two ways. There's two different ways that you could do a separation, right? And again, this is obviously the cheesy cartoon. I guess the Boston Marathon was a couple days ago. This is not Boston. I don't know where it is. But so if you start off with a big, long initial plug, right, much like a marathon, right, so if you start with a big, long thing, then obviously you have to wait a long time for the fastest guy in the rear to outrun the slowest guy in the front. So in the marathon problem, they solve this problem by putting all the fastest people in the front anyway. But in principle, if you wait long enough, then, you know, then gradually these people will actually separate out into the fastest to the slowest. Okay? Whereas if you do something like a sprint, right, where everybody's single file, right, in that case, you don't need so long a track, right? And so in a sprint, you know, 100 meters, you can separate out the fastest from the slowest, okay? And so on some level, you know, there's different reasons to do each of these two different kinds of things, but Max was interested in, he wanted to basically do very rapid separations in sort of a very short distance, and so the idea was, well, let's just make a very sharp plug like this, and then it won't take so long for the slowest guy to outrun the fastest guy, or actually the other way around, okay? So this is the ideal situation. You have your sample, you have a waste. This is the channel within which you do the separation, right? You inject sample across it, and ideally it looks like this, right? So then you have, this is again your single file line of runners, and then you apply the field, they separate, okay? And the problem is that that doesn't work, okay? And this is what happens. So here what we're doing, or what Max is doing really, to be fair, is injecting from here across the channel. And again, what you like is this nice, tight little band, but instead it kind of squashes out into this mushroom. All right, so you get this, A, a non-uniform plug, and B, it's, you know, much thicker than you'd like. Okay, so well, let's make it a thinner channel, right? Well, maybe we can just solve that problem by making a thinner channel. And in fact, it doesn't work, right?
Which way is the separation?
The separation will eventually go this way. Okay, that's right. And so the issue with actually making this channel thinner, you know, so you might say, well, let's just make it thinner, and that way, yeah, you might have this mushroom, but it'll be smaller. Turns out the mushroom winds up being exactly the same size, effectively. And so it actually doesn't help, right? And so what's going on? Why does this happen? And how can we get rid of it, right? So the point is that the analyte, the concentration of the stuff in here, right, it follows field lines. It's transported along the field lines, either electroosmotically or electrophoretically, right? And so what do the field lines look like? So this is a simulation. It's a rather simple simulation. And you can see that, in fact, the field lines don't make nice straight lines across the channel, as you would expect, it being a Laplacian field and all. But in fact, they spread into the channel, kind of transverse, right? The asymmetry comes just because the field strength gets weaker and weaker this way, so as they're being injected in here, you know, they're kind of going slowly this way. I mean, if you waited a long, long, long time, I think eventually it would get to be symmetric, but anyway. So that's what's wrong. The electric field lines are not actually confined to this channel intersection, and so this nice sharp plug that you wanted to make, you can't make. Okay? So here's the idea, right? So let's try to sculpt the electric field lines. Right, the analyte's going to follow the electric field lines. So if we can make the electric field lines go where we want them to go, then the analyte will too. Okay, and so again, this is a picture from an article that Bob Austin's group had, I guess, some time ago now, where they've done this sort of thing, you know, for a different context, where they have asymmetric, you know, they have these funny arrays of, you know, cylindrical posts or these whatever you call them, ellipsoidal posts or something like this. Right, and they use this for DNA separation. Eric Cummings and actually, I don't know if Feichner's, I think it's Greg Feichner, did something a few years back. This is addressing the same issue that I believe that Sandeep Gosal talked about, although again, I was teaching, so I didn't hear it. But how do you prevent dispersion from happening kind of as bands turn corners, right? And so what they did is they actually microfabricated various, you know, effective porous media to, on some level, you know, get the thing to turn. You know, again, it's along these ideas of sculpting the transport. Okay. So what do we need to do, right? We need to have these channels, right? We need to avoid these things bulging out into the sides, okay? And so you need basically that you need something in this channel that will prevent these field lines from getting into it, right? So it should be impermeable to the transfers to fields across this way. This channel should be impermeable, but it should actually, you know, once you've injected your sample and you then apply a field that way, you actually need these channels, obviously, to be permeable to electric field lines or permittive to electric field lines in that direction, right? And so the idea is, well, let's make it an anisotropic porous media, okay? And so how do you do it? You know, it's kind of highfalutin language, and really it's very simple. Just microfabricate, you know, a series of partitions, right, in the channel itself, okay? And so here, basically the idea is, if you think about this, for, you know, there's a variety of ways you can look at this. One is that, you know, you've got a series of walls, fine. Another way is, if you think about it, if you sort of abstract it a bit, this is effectively a porous medium whose permittivity is anisotropic. Right, it's highly non-permittive to fields, again, kind of going through it in that direction, but it's, you know, essentially totally permittive to fields going that direction. Okay? And so these are, again, these same simulations. This is without these partitions, that's with. You can see that the field lines really just, you know, stay confined to where they're supposed to go. So this is a simple idea. It's basically geometry, right? And so it's independent of what you make the stuff out of. It's compatible with gels. None of these things actually affect the physics at all. And so it's really a rather a general strategy. So how does it work? Right, so this is a picture that the danger I have with coffee and laser pointers is I do this a lot. This is initially what I showed you before, right? This injection with this mushroom. This is now when Max put these partitions in, right? Well, these are negatively charged things, so they actually go opposite the electric field at the time, right? So you see already that you have a very nice sharp plug that you formed. This is actually a fairly high aspect ratio. It's 5:1, I believe. And so no mushrooming at all, right? Nice sharp channel. And then it's actually a mixture of fluorescein and carboxyfluorescein, you know, which differ by one charge. And so then when he applies an electric field, you see these things separate, just bang right out of the gate, right?
So what's 5:1 aspect ratio?
Oh, this is it's the width of this to the.
But is it the porous medium?
No, actually, no. The plug itself, right? So this rectangle here is 5:1. At least that's the plan. Okay. Yes.
The reason why you wouldn't narrow the actual separation channel just at the locus of injection is that for detection reason or something.
So say it again. So the reason that you wouldn't.
Because of the, like. Narrowing the injection channel, not the separation channel,
right.
Before,
uh-huh.
And that left the size of the mushroom the same,
mm-hmm.
Because it was basically the width,
right.
Of the separation channel. But you could just taper the separation channel,
right.
To the place of injection,
right.
Make it very thin.
Right.
But the point is,
so
the problem with that, you would have less sample?
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, basically, a different way to say what you're saying is that, you know, Laplace's equation is scale-free. And so however you make this, basically the width of this mushroom is going to be, roughly speaking, set by the width of the largest channel. And so, you know, sensibly, the sensible thing to do is to always make square intersections, because you're never going to do better than that anyway, right? And then you can scale it out or scale it down as you like, and it won't actually matter. Whereas something like this, one thing that's nice is you have a short axial extent to this plug, but then for detection, you can actually integrate along, you can integrate the intensity along that and pick it up better. That's right. So one thing that Max noticed, and actually I didn't believe him for a long time, but he kept telling me that it was true. I had this picture that, well, you know, I know how Laplace's equation works. You have harmonics in one direction, and these are periodic. So you have sort of these periodic wiggles, and so therefore it's going to be harmonic in one dimension. And we, being in a math department right here, know that, in fact, if it's harmonic in one direction, it's exponential in the other direction. And so it should, basically the sample should exponentially tail off into those things. And Max kept telling me, no, look, I see this stuff. And eventually, I was forced to believe him. And so what happens? Why is this going on, right? So basically, you can look. These are at different times. This is FedLab simulations that he did, okay? And so you can see initially as he injects, right, everything looks the way it should. The sample is staying where it is. But you can see there's these pesky little bits that start leaking through. And if you leave it long enough, it actually starts to look like the original mushroom, and even worse. And the reason is that there actually are field lines that get out, right? again, you know, in a math department, it's Laplace's equation, everything's sort of non-local in some funny way. And so there are, you know, if these were infinitely long, these partitions, then in fact, the picture I had in mind would be right, but they're not infinitely long, and so some guys can't get out, very few of them do, but some do, right? And so, in any event, so because of that, there are some analyte does actually kind of leak into these side partitions and go, right? So, you can basically make simple little estimates, and so you can, actually I probably won't go on this, but you can estimate how many field lines leak, what's the field strength, how fast will it go, and so on, and that gives you relationships like this, like the total fraction of this channel that will leak out, right? Is something like this. It's the number of partitions, the width of the partition divided by the length of the partition, and so on. Actually the width of the distance in between them, right? So this on some level gives you design, you know, it either tells you, roughly speaking, what to expect, or it tells you how you might want to design things to do a better job. And so Max then had the idea to use a sheath flow, right? So instead of simply, what he's doing now is this is just applying your electric field along here. The stuff goes through here, and again, you see this is without any partitions in the side, okay? And basically, the idea is to keep the sample now, instead of having, you know, like this, where the sample is all going across, I have to get this right. The idea was that some of these field lines are going to leak out, and so let's keep the sample on those field lines that don't actually leak out at the sides, right? So that was the idea. And so by using a sheaf flow, there's two channels that come in here that are empty, that are blank, and then you've got your sample in the middle, right? And you can tune sort of the width, how much, you know, how much of the channel is occupied by sample versus the sort of clear bits on the side. And if you're clever, you could actually tune that just right so that all of the sample remains on the field lines that are confined within this intersection, and then, you know, the clear bits kind of go out. And so this was a control just to demonstrate that when you use sheaf flows with these without partitions, you still get this kind of bulging, right? It's not so bad as the mushroom had been before, but you still get this kind of bulging. Whereas now this is with the partitions, you know, again, the drama here is that you can't actually see the partitions because there's just absolutely nothing there. There's none of the fluorescent marker is there, so you just wouldn't see them. But anyway, so that's sort of a, you know, a modification to this picture. So there's all sorts of things that you can do. So Max was able to do, so these are these separations that I showed before. Again, it's very, very rapid. It's within 100 or 200 microns of the channel. And these things are already clearly resolved. You can do it repetitively as well, you know, I mean, all sorts of things. So I'm going to take a step back, right? So that's sort of the general picture, or that's sort of a nice cartoon example of this, you know, thought. And so I want to take a step back and say, well, let's think about, in general, with porous media like this, right, where let's say you can make whatever you want, right? So on just the simplest level, ignoring surface chemistry, et cetera, right, the electrokinetic transport through something like this, right, so electroosmotic flow set up around these walls, et cetera, that is going to basically only a function of the geometry of the unit cell itself. You can scale this unit cell up and down, and it won't matter on some level, right? I mean, it basically means that the permittivity is sort of a function of the unit cell, and therefore the electroosmotic flows as well. Okay. Hydrodynamically, however, that's not true. The velocities that you get will now scale with sort of the size of the unit cell squared, right, at times some different function of the geometry of the unit cell. Right? And so what's kind of nice about this is that you have two different features. You've got a scale, right? And then you've got three different functions. This will give you sort of, you know, factors of two or three difference between these guys. Whereas the scale, you can make whatever you want. So the point is that you can scale, or you can tune the scale of this porous media and the geometry itself independently. And this has been used, as I'll talk about in about 2 minutes, basically, asymmetry, the difference between electroosmotic flows and pressure-driven flows through porous media, forms the basis for very classic techniques in high-pressure pumps that are based on electric. So I'll talk about how those work in about 2 minutes. But so here's a funny observation. I don't know if it's good for anything, but I'm now in a mathematics institute, and so therefore I can talk about things that may or may not be good for anything. So the idea is that, again, there's two different knobs that you can tune in when looking at the hydrodynamic flows through something like this. You've got basically the size of the pore, and then you've got a geometry. Okay? And so it turns out You know, and I've played around with toy examples of this. You can actually make porous materials with different different scales and different geometric, you know, unit cells, for example, but actually have the exact same hydrodynamic permeability. And what that means, sort of on the, you know, again, on the, you know, taking a step back, this is what determines on some level the, I mean, all of this obeys Darcy's equation, you know, it's essentially Laplace's equation for the pressure, right? And so the flow lines for different materials like this will actually just be straight lines, right? They're the you know, they have the same permeability. So I am drawing here a cartoon of, you know, one porous medium with some, you know, funny properties like this, and then a triangle of another one, okay? And the point is that the flow lines then, as far as the pressure, the Laplacian equation that you solve for the for the pressure, right? The flow lines actually just go straight through these interfaces. I mean, you know, from the standpoint of the permeability, there's no difference between these two guys. However, the flow speed within those two guys are different. And so if I were to take, say, a plug, start to push it up this way, and there are issues with this, you know, you can feel free to yell at me in 2 seconds, right? But so basically, on average, the flow, you know, basically the flow lines will go straight. However, the flow within this bit will, you know, it's slower here than it is outside and so on. And so you could take a nice, sharp, straight plug like this, send it through there, it would come out with this funny triangle shape. You could then, you know, anyway. My point in saying this is by playing with these properties, you could actually, you know, you could manipulate plugs and so on. I don't know that it's actually useful, but it's sort of something to get your brain working at 9 in the morning. So I mentioned this, these high-pressure electroosmotic flow pumps. This, to my knowledge, goes back to Austerlitz. It may go back even further. But at least that's sort of where I have seen it first. The basic idea is that it's much easier to drive a flow electrokinetically through a porous medium than it is but then using a pressure. And the reason is that the flow, due to pressure-driven flows, scales like the square of the size of the pore, right? Whereas the flow, the velocities that you get electrokinetically are actually independent of the pore size, right? And the reason is that you get, with electrokinetics, as I'll talk about in about 2 minutes, you get, actually, you know what? I'm going to delay this because I haven't talked about electrokinetics. You've heard about it, but I will make the provocative claim, in fact. So basically, these pumps will give you, for kilovolts of applied pressure, they'll give you hundreds of atmospheres. So they're tremendously high pressure pumps. I mean, think about 100 atmospheres, so a lot. And so I'm going to make the claim, whether you believe it or not, and I'll talk about it, that you can sort of do the same kind of thing actually with a 1-volt battery or a 5-volt battery or something like that. Okay, you can get these same pressures. So that's the claim. This is what it's all going to culminate in. And so I'll start, actually, so maybe it's good that Steve's not here because I'm going to make a little joke. So 3 of these 4 are his. So these are all nice little microfluidic devices. They're all shown next to coins because it shows off how fancy these little things are. This is a little chemostat, a bacterial chemostat that Frederick Malligan made. Is that how much they cost?
Yeah.
You know, it's actually not. It's probably not far off.
Yeah, 25 cents.
You know, well, the labor of putting together is probably more than the materials, but it's essentially glorified caulk. You know, that you pour in a. You know, it's really remarkable. So, the funny thing about this is, yeah, even though you draw pictures of these guys, they have this dirty little secret, which is that, in fact, you need a lab full of stuff to actually make them run. And in particular, in this case, you see all of these little lines coming off. Some of those are fluidic lines, right, that actually drive in the fluids that you're using. And then some of them are high-pressure air lines that are used to open and close valves, right? And so for the most part, to be fair, just like your desktop computer, you don't actually need to carry these things around. For the most part, so you don't need a bacterial chemostat in your pocket, probably. Whereas, you know, you can imagine if you could carry them around or implant them, for example, you could do the equivalent of microfluidic pacemakers, have implantable devices, and so on, right? But to do that, you actually need to be able to drive fluids in a portable and self-contained way, right? So that's sort of where I'm going to go. I'm going to talk about something that Martin and I call discharge electroosmosis. This is sort of an umbrella term for a whole variety of nonlinear electrokinetic effects that I'll talk about in a little bit. And again, this will culminate in ideas that involve tailoring sort of funny porous materials that harness this effect and that I claim will actually get us, you know, 10 atmospheres for a volt, something like that. Okay? So basically, what do we need for a portable microfluidic device? What do you actually need? Right? So you need something which is self-contained, no external pumps, no killable power supplies, no compressed air, etc. Okay. You want it to be battery powered, right? Well, I guess this follows from that. You don't want it to mess up the fluid, right? Should be fairly versatile, easy to fabricate, and integral, right? So what I'm going to do, I'm going to talk about this effect, this induced charge electroosmosis. I'm going to give some background on electrostatics and electrokinetics, the sort of 5-minute version. Talk basically about ICEO, induced charge electroosmosis, and that's a variance, and then I'll bring it all together if I have time. So this is a stupid joke, but this is basically a continuum view of water, right? Doesn't look like much, it just has a dielectric constant. Whereas in fact, in water, there's all these ions floating around, right? They could be salt that dissociated. It could also be water molecules themselves that dissociate. But the point is that water actually kind of on the, you know, at least for our purposes, it's very important that it has these free charges floating around, okay? And so if you have a wall that's charged, right? Well, in general, everything's charged in water. Some things are not, but those are special cases, right? There's lots of reasons why everything's charged, but if you have a surface like a microscope slide or something like that, in general it will be charged, and in general then it will actually attract the opposite sign charges from the solution that will then kind of organize themselves along. They basically will set up a little cloud that screens out the charge, all right? And in general that cloud, the screening itself happens over some light scale. Typically it's between a nanometer, the maximum it can be theoretically, possibly is a micron. The longest I've ever seen is a few hundred nanometers, but people work very, very hard to get it like that. So typically, you know, the thing to keep in mind for this this length scale is it's typically a nanometer, 10 nanometers, something like that, right? And these charge clouds are typically characterized by the potential drop across them, right? So you've probably heard this by now. Juan talked yesterday, so I'm sure he talked about this somewhat. You apply an electric field that pushes the ions, right? The ions are then forced through their fluid. In the bulk, it doesn't matter because as many positive as there are negative, so everything averages out. Whereas in this little charge cloud, in fact, there's more positive than negative here, and so therefore there's a net force, in this case to the right, and these guys drag fluid along with them, okay? And so the fluid is dragging along for the ride, and what it does is it sets up effectively a little conveyor belt, a little tank tread, right? And so, actually, so this was Juan's, did Juan use the paint on the wall example yesterday? No, okay. So Juan Santiago, in a talk I heard him give once, made the following analogy that I thought was very nice, which is that if this room is a microchannel, and it works with any room, because all rooms are, you know, in a scaling sense, the same size, and you apply an electric field, you're driving electroosmotic flow, okay? So if you think about the width of this, you know, nanometer, 10 nanometer screening length compared to the size of your channel, right, Juan's analogy, and maybe it wasn't his, but that's where I got it, was that that basically, if you think about setting up electroosmotic flow in the same room, this charge cloud is effectively the thickness of the paint on the wall, right? So these electroosmotic flows that you drive are literally, it's like, you know, applying electric field, and it's like the paint on the wall is moving, and then the rest of the fluid in the room is dragged with it, okay? So anyway, what is the, I think I distill it. So the basic thing that you need to remember for this whole thing is that you have a charge on the wall, right? You apply an electric field that gives you effectively a slip velocity, so that, you know, it's like the wall is moving. That slip velocity is proportional to the field that you apply, and this zeta potential, the potential drop across there, which is in turn, roughly speaking, proportional to the charge density on the wall. All right. The significant thing is it actually doesn't depend on the size of that screening length, right? Okay. So I'll probably blow through this somewhat fast. There are reasons that people, so for a while people were very excited about electroosmotic flows for microchannels. A big reason is that if you look at this, basically the velocities you get have nothing to do with the size of the channel, right? All the action happens in this 1 nanometer. So even if you have a 10 nanometer channel, if you have a 1 nanometer screening length, in theory anyway, you'll get the same velocity. So the velocities do not scale at all. They don't scale with the size of the channel. And so as we make smaller and smaller microfluidic channels, the rationale went, we're going to be able to, it'll be easier and easier to pump things this way electroosmotically, just because they don't scale in the same way that the pressure-driven flows do. Okay? So that was a big advantage that there's a lot of attention paid to. There are disadvantages, however. One of them is that you need a high DC voltage. Basically, these things are the potentials are applied along the channels, So typically they're applied along at centimeter, 10 centimeters, something of that order, and so you need kilovolts, right? Also, other things that happen is that electrochemical reactions have to occur on these electrodes in order to drive a current, right? And so you might not want bubbles in your device. You might not want metal ions in your device, et cetera. Okay? Another thing that happened, and this I think is probably the reason that a lot of that discouraged a lot of people about this, is that stuff will always stick to walls. Okay? This is now a picture from Abe Stroop's paper, where experimentally he deliberately patterned the charge on these walls, and instead of seeing this nice plug flow that I showed two slides ago, instead of seeing this nice perfect, you know, everything just moves like it's on a conveyor belt, you know, you see these rolls. Okay? Now this has been used for various reasons. However, it means that in general, if you have a non-trivial solution that you're pumping around, right, it's hard to do things controllably and you know, repeatably, because you know, if you're plugging a protein solution down, proteins will stick to the wall, it changes its charge density, it changes all the characteristics and so on. So that's a big mess and a big difficulty. And then finally, you can imagine if what you're able to do is basically control the potentials at each of these little points here, that it can be really hard to actually, you know, control, oh, I want to pump fluid right there, but not right there, and so on. Right? So it's hard to actually integrate it. Okay? So, all right, what is ICEO? Right? I feel like I've been talking a lot. So this is a conductor.
Something to do with your advisor, maybe.
Yell at me if there's something that you'd rather I be talking about. So if this, so now imagine this is a metal post, right? And so we all learned in first year physics, if we took first year physics, that the field around a metal post looks like this. It has to hit at right angles because it's an equipotential surface, right? And so, hi Steve. So I made jokes about you.
You missed it. So my ears were burning.
So this is sort of the, if you were to turn in your homework in physics 1, you would get 100%. However, in this world now, so remember there are now ions floating around, okay? And those ions then are free to move as they like, so you drive ohmic currents, basically. And so positive ions move this way along with the field, negative ions move against the field, right? And what happens now when they actually get to the surface, right? They have to make a decision. Well, actually, they don't get to make a decision. They do what physics tells them to do. But we have to make a decision to figure out what happens to them. The only way that they can actually cross that surface, right, that these charges can cross that surface, is if there's an electrochemical reaction that lets them do that, right? But unless you have a very high potential, that's not going to happen, okay? And so instead what happens is that these guys accumulate, okay? So what happens is you build up a dipolar charge cloud, okay? You get positive charges on one side, negative ions on the other side. And in the end, after some screening time, this is effectively an RC circuit. You've got sort of two double layer, these charge clouds are like capacitors, and they go through a resistive medium. There's an RC time associated with the charging of that, right? And so basically after this RC time, quote unquote, you get a perfectly, sort of the field itself looks like it's around a perfect insulator, and you have this dipolar charge cloud, okay? So this basic picture actually goes way back. This one in particular, I believe, goes back to Simonov and Sheila in the 70s, but this general picture actually goes, you know, farther back than that. So what happens now when you actually apply, basically what happens in steady state? You've got this dipolar charge cloud, you've got tangential fields, they kind of wrap around this thing, and so they drive electroosmotic flows, right? On the bottom, the field is pointed to the right, you have a positive charge cloud, and so you get your little conveyor belt. You know, basically goes from the pole to the equator kind of on these two sides. On the top, the field is going sort of to, you know, towards the pole. And you have a negative charge, so in fact, you get a slip velocity in the opposite direction. Okay? And so, yes?
I just wondered, you mentioned about the electrochemical reaction.
Yes. Yeah, it absolutely does. So it has, I don't actually understand it all that well. I mean, so electrochemistry is in my mind a dizzying field. And again, one of these fields that's been around for, you know, 100 years at least. But it has to do with a lot of things. It has to do with the specific chemical nature of the ions themselves. I mean, you have to basically you need to be able to drive electrochemical reactions, right? And so yes, it entirely depends. Well, it doesn't entirely, but it most definitely depends on how strong the field is that you're applying. You know, in particular, it depends on how strong based on how large this potential drop is across here, you know, which is going to be directly related to this issue, right? And then it also depends on the actual nature of the surfaces and the ions that you have and so on as to which, you know, which of the many different different ionic reactions, electrochemical reactions will occur. But yeah, so it depends on a lot of things.
If your obstacle was a dielectric to begin with,
yeah,
any of this be different? Because ultimately you started with a conductor and
right,
it's essentially...
Yeah, so it's actually a very good point. So the question is if this were instead of... So a conductor is sort of the perfect case of this, but of course any polarizable particle will do the same thing. The difference is, okay, and it's actually a bit of a... Well, I don't know if it's subtle or not, but the difference is that in this case, the potential drop, so the you know the potential right here is a constant, and so the zeta potential that you set up is exactly the difference between this point right there and the potential in bulk just outside. Whereas if you have a dielectric body or a coated metallic body, then some of that potential can actually drop across the dielectric bit. And it just turns out then it's still, you can still represent it as an RC, you know, except now you've got an additional capacitance in the dielectric itself. And it turns out that typically that totally swamps the double layer capacitance, right? So this is why, for example, that you almost never see this in non-metallic systems. Right? And there's a case that where you do that I know of anyway, but you have to work pretty hard to see it. Okay? So and I'll actually use that back later on, actually. So in any event, so what you get a double layer, the zeta potential that scales like the strength of the field. So this goes back to your question and the size of the body. The electroosmotic flow you get basically scales with the strength of the field and that zeta potential, so it actually goes like the square of the field, right? Square of the field times the size of the body, okay? So you now have a nonlinear electrokinetic effect, right? We call it induced charge electroosmotic flow because basically you're reducing the charge cloud and then you're driving it. This is in fact a much, it's a very general phenomenon that appears in many different contexts, and I'll talk about them in about two slides, I think. You can think of this as an umbrella, you know, an umbrella picture. And in fact, in the colloidal context, this exact picture really goes back at least to Leverage in the 60s. Okay. So what happens when you reverse the field, right? So this, I've done that. If you reverse the field, right, you reverse the sign of the induced charges and you get the same flow, right? So this means that you can write an AC field and you'll get a steady flow, right? So there's that. And in fact, you can, you know, if you take the actual charging time seriously, it modifies that. But that's actually just a detail. Okay. So I kind of had mentioned this a few times. You know, what are the various related effects? Here are a number of them. And we're by no means the first or anything, to have thought about this. So this idea of this sort of induced charge electroosmotic flow around metallic colloids, again, was explored in the Ukrainian colloidal literature. Initially, if you read Levitch's book, you know, they talk about this, but he talks about it insofar as to say that it basically doesn't affect the electrophoretic mobility of a metallic particle. And then Gamayunov, Dukhin, Rutzovkin, people like this, in the late 80s, they actually really took care to think about what are the flows that are set up around metallic colloids, how does that affect their interactions, and so on. So this is exactly what I was just talking about, okay? Taylor and Melcher and others of that grand stature invented the field of electrohydrodynamics, which are similar. They're not the same, but they're similar, right? You have two different oil drops of different conductivities, and basically applying a field because of a conductivity mismatch here, you build up sort of the conductivity mismatch leads to a bound charge that occurs on these surfaces. That gives electrical stresses that then drive quadrupolar flows that, in fact, look exactly the same as they do for the ICEO. More recently, in the microfluidic context, there's a Spanish group, Ramos, Gonzalez, Nick Green was part of that as well, that talk about AC electroosmosis. Armand, who's here as well, did something very similar in diffusion. And here, it's basically the same physics, right? Here, they're applying an AC field across two planar electrodes, okay? The AC field establishes a charge cloud and then drives it, right? So again, you get this flow that arises because you've created a charge cloud and then you've driven it, okay? And that is, in fact, this is called the literature, AC electroosmosis, because in the DC limit, it actually doesn't exist. In the DC limit, you just screen out these electrodes, and then nothing happens anymore, right? And then finally, the last thing, so this is Bill Ristenpart's picture, but in fact, it goes back sometime before that. Basically, this is now looking down at an electrode where there's an AC field applied. These are little colloids, and it turns out that colloids will self-assemble on a long electrode under an AC field, and it has to do with the induced charge cloud beneath, basically the fact that those guys perturb the field that changes the charge dynamics beneath each of these colloids. It sets up this induced charge like osmotic flow, or my umbrella term for it anywhere, Martin's and mine, and it leads to this kind of aggregation. So this kind of thing actually shows up quite a bit. One of Martin's students did these experiments. So this is a metal post, an AC field up and down, right? I think it's a 300 hertz field, right? And so the basic thing I want you to notice, this is a post here. You have a quadrupolar flow. You're only seeing one part of it, right? And it's actually a pretty vigorous flow. This is several hundred microns a second. It's 100 volts per centimeter is the field strength. This thing is about, I think it's about 100 microns, but I forget actually. So, you obviously aren't seeing any AC fields or any AC effects. You're just seeing a steady flow. And, obviously also there's no moving parts, just kind of going. All right, yes?
Is there like particle sting?
Yeah, there's particle sting to it. Jeremy told me about this. So I believe this is two things. I believe this is, so this is a metallic post. I believe part of it is that the thing is actually not totally vertical, and so on some level you're seeing some you're seeing kind of reflections as well. But this is sort of a fabrication, artifact or something. I don't know what you call it.
If you have a particle that plate that's sticking onto the metal, then it would be really hard to draw. Would they be considered as a layer by that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So if these were all to stick to that metal, then yeah, you could think of it as a dielectric layer, and you could have the problems that I was talking about. Absolutely. So one thing that is true is that you need to work in low conductivities for this to work, right? And that's because you need basically the double layer capacitance to be good enough that whatever else is happening on that interface doesn't overwhelm it. All right. So I'm going to skip that. All right. That's a basic picture. So a couple things I'll say. One. Being mindful of the time. So one is that basically, why does this work? This works because you have an induced charge cloud that varies in phase with the field that you're applying, right? That's how this works. And so anything that you do that causes this induced charge cloud to vary in phase with the field, no matter what it is, anything you do will actually lead to a steady flow, right? So that's observation number one. And so one thing that you can do is, this is a metal, right? So you can control the potential of that if you like. Right, and so that's what so we call that fixed potential induced charge electroosmosis. It actually has no, so this one has no colloidal analog because you can't actually hold the colloids in some fixed potential, right? And basically the idea is this: so say you take this post and you short it out to the electrode, right? During this half of the cycle, right? Basically, this guy here is at a higher potential than its surroundings. It induces a negative charge cloud. The field itself, on average, is to the right, and so you'll actually set up a flow, which is to the left, okay? On the reverse cycle, right, on the 180 degrees out of phase, basically now the field is going in the opposite direction. He's at a lower potential than his surroundings. You induce a positive charge cloud, and again, you get a flow to the right. And so the flow that you get will look like this. It's always towards the electrode that it is shorted to. You can also tune this in any way you like at some level. One other thing. The length scale that appears here now is actually the length between the post and the electrode rather than the size of the post itself. So it actually can be bigger. So here's an example of that. If I can get it to play. These again are Jeremy Levitan's experiments. There we go. So one thing that you can notice is that the fields are, the flows actually are quite a bit faster. They're not looping, but they're quite a bit faster, and they're all in that direction. Okay? So everything I've talked about have been circular cylindrical posts. Right, so you get this nice symmetric flow, quadrupolar flow, and at some point, maybe long ago, you started to wonder, what is this guy talking about? Why is he telling us about quantum microfluidics, etc.? Right, and so this is now where it's going to start to come in. Okay, so if you have an asymmetric shape, you'll get an asymmetric flow. It's kind of not surprising in retrospect. Right, so if you have a four-aft asymmetric body, the thing would actually want to swim towards its blunt end. If you have a left-right asymmetric body, it'll want to swim towards its pointed end. Okay. Conversely, if you held them in place, they would pump fluid in the opposite direction. Okay. So you can start to ask questions like this. So if you take a body that is initially symmetric and you make perturbations to that shape. So, you know, the simplest shape that perturbs, basically the simplest perturbation that makes it fore-aft asymmetric, or, you know, basically makes it, you know, left-right or fore-aft asymmetric is sort of these Legendre polynomials, the P3, right? Any of these odd Legendre polynomials, anything that makes it kind of pointy, you know, in one direction will cause the thing to translate, okay? It'll translate either parallel or perpendicular to the field, depending on the relative orientation of the field and that perturbation, right? Any even perturbations, right, making it oblong or squat, right, will actually cause the thing to rotate. So you've got some set of perturbations that cause it to translate, some set that cause it to rotate, okay? And so this then forms the basis for, you know, I mean, if you wanted to do this, I don't know why you would actually want to do this, but if you did, you could, to sort of design principles for if you wanted to make funny-shaped metallic beasts that would swim around in whatever direction you wanted, you could do it, right? So if you take a fore-aft, you know, a P3, right, make it pointy, and you align that with a perturbation that makes it oblong, so you now have something which is oblong and pointy, both axes the same, this thing will then want to align with the field, and then it'll swim towards its blunt end, okay? So under an AC field, this thing will basically swim towards the blunt end, and, you know. You could also take this kind of pointy thing, combine it with a shape asymmetry, which is, you know, makes it kind of squat along the pointy axis, right? And now what this thing will do is it'll actually, the P2 axis, you know, rotates to align with the field. But that is now, that means that this perturbation is perpendicular to the field and the thing's going to swim actually towards a sharp end. So you can basically kind of play around with this kind of thing and make things align in any direction you want and swim in any direction you want. Again, whether you want to or not, I don't know. So we talked about this a little bit in the questions. What is the effect of coding this thing, right? So the basic effect is you're adding another capacitor that suppresses the charge cloud itself, and therefore it reduces the effect of this induced charge electroosmosis. Okay? You know, it means one thing. It means that you have to keep your surface very clean, or you have to work in low conductivity solutions. But the other thing that you can do is actually now you can start playing with the symmetry properties of the coating itself. Right? So if you actually coat only half of this particle, right, then you'll get a strong ICEO flow over the other half. And so if this is now a post that's, say, half-coated, what you'll get is, you know, basically something that will, you can apply an AC field across the channel and drive a steady flow along a channel, right? So you can drive a flow perpendicular to the field that you're applying, okay? And this is something that Armand pointed out some time back, 2002, I think, I might even talk about it, that basically a nice feature of that is that you can then apply a small voltage, you know, a volt across, say, 100 microns, get the same field that would, you know, that you would get with 10 kilovolts along 10 centimeters, right? So it's a way of now taking a small potential, turning it into a large field, but still driving a flow in the direction you want. Okay, so these are just funny things that you can do. Obviously, if you put a whole bunch of these in a channel, apply an AC field across it, you'll get a pump, right? And I'll actually going to exponentiate this in 2 seconds. You know, if you kind of made some funny body that was hooked together like this, it would, no matter what direction of field you apply, it would actually spin around. Again, I don't know that it's good for anything, but it's kind of cute. Okay, so back to these electroosmotic flow pumps, and then I'm going to wrap up. How do these things work? Because the electroosmotic flow, the electrokinetic flows, are set up within 10 nanometers of a surface, right? Because of that, even if you have a very, you know, if you have a porous plug, you know, you pack a bunch of colloidal beads, right? So long as the spaces between the pores are more than 10 nanometers or a nanometer, right, as far as the electroosmotic flow is concerned, this may as well be an open channel. It doesn't matter. Right? You'll get as strong a flow through this electroosmotically as if the plug wasn't there in the first place. It's a pretty remarkable fact, actually. It's kind of magic. Now, if you were to try to do the same thing with the pressure, however, because the pores are so narrow, you need a tremendous pressure to do so. Right, because this pore gets so small, you need a compensatingly large pressure drop to drive the same flow. Okay, so what happens now if you actually take a porous plug, right, and you put it in a closed channel, right, so the two ends are capped, and then you apply an electric field along here? Well, electrically, electrokinetically, you drive a flow, electrodes. However, the flow has nowhere to go, and we can't destroy fluid, right? And so what winds up happening is that you build up a very large pressure, large enough to drive the same pressure driven flow in reverse, right? You need basically no net flow in any direction because the flow's got nowhere to go. So you necessarily have to get a very large pressure, large enough to drive the equivalent counter-directed pressure driven flow, right? And so basically what happens is that you balance these two fluxes and you get a pressure drop which scales like this. It scales like the Zeta potential, the voltage that you apply, and it goes 1 over the size of the force squared. And so by making, basically packing a bed of, 10 nanometer, 20 nanometer, 50 nanometer silica spheres, for example, you can get extremely high pressure drops with, say, kilovolts. And in particular, you can get, say, hundreds of atmospheres, if you apply 10 kilovolts along 10 centimeters. Okay? And so my claim here is that you can actually get these same kinds of pressures, maybe not 100, but maybe 110, with the battery. Okay? And what I'm going to do is just going to kind of bring it all together. So what I'm going to propose is the following, and this is actually something that I have a graduate student now doing this, is that we're going to make a porous medium, right? We're going to basically take a bed, a packed colloidal bed, where now the pores themselves are asymmetrically coated, right? So we're playing with the local properties of this porous medium, okay? So that they're half metallic and half dielectric, okay? And we're going to pack it in an oriented fashion. And now I will claim that driving an AC field across this channel leverages this fact that you can get a very large field with a small applied voltage, right? The fact that it's AC means you don't actually drive electrochemical reactions. And basically what you'll get around each of these guys is an induced charge electroosmotic flow that is directed along the channel. And so now all of the physics that I was just talking about the sort of these high pressure electrokinetic pumps, the same physics basically translates directly over. Okay? It's slightly different in that it now scales with the pressure that you'll get from this kind of an ICEO pump will actually go like the square of the applied voltage. It has a different scaling for a variety of reasons. But long and short is, if you believe this kind of an argument, and to some degree it's right, then you should really get 110. I don't know about 100, but of the order of magnitude of 1 to 10 atmospheres now with something like a volt or 10 volts, right? So I think that'd be pretty great, actually. And I also think that it would actually allow you to take a lot of current devices that now exist out of the lab and in your pocket. So what I've tried to argue here, just in this little section, is basically, what you need for a portable microfluidic driving. You need to be self-contained, battery-powered, can't foul the fluid, versatile, robust, easy to fabricate, interval. Well, you can make the issue, you can raise the objection, is this thing really easy to fabricate that I just talked about? But we have ideas to do that. But basically, I would argue that this effect and sort of some of these manifestations I've talked about actually kind of would allow you to do this, all of this. Okay? And just to remind you, the kind of little warm-up problem that we talked about was this work with Matt Marlansky, with the idea of actually using microfabricating anisotropic, in this case, porous media, to sculpt fields. And then I will close kind of where I began, is just kind of asking this general question, trying to think about the effective media, the effective properties of porous media, where now you can really control essentially everything about them. What other things can you do, and to what end? So I will stop.